This is Richard Horvitz, and you are listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 38, Knickknacks and Chit Chat.
The two of us have been reading some interesting things that we've acquired, and there's been an interesting trend we found in some of the books we've been looking at recently. And as a result, we have some advice, a few ideas for the comic book industry. We're going to run them by you.
But first, a little feedback. We start with a pretty long email from Darren Sutherland of the Trekker Talk podcast. On our TV review episodes, it's actually a composite of two emails since we did multiple TV-based episodes. So I wanted to start with this one because it gives us a chance to talk about what our viewing plans are for this season's comic book TV shows.
Hi, Professor Allen and Emily. Ruth and I are big Doctor Who fans, both the classic series and the new one. The show is never perfect, but it is consistently imaginative. I've been thrilled to now have Peter Capaldi as the Doctor. His performance is completely different from David Tennant and Matt Smith, and that helps the show be fresh again, even when watching a mediocre episode.
Three episodes of Doctor Who's new season are out as we record this, and we've watched two of them, and I enjoyed the first two-parter. I even liked the fish tank joke. And the Doctor as rock and roll musician.
Since they said that Doctor Who frequently has mediocre episodes, which are still enjoyable, that is sort of what I felt about the first two-parter. It was not great. But I was enjoying myself, and that's much better than happened with, like, late Matt Smith episodes where they were mediocre and boring. This was not boring. My love affair with Stephen Moffat is well and truly over, and now he's just sort of this uncomfortable ex who occasionally drifts into my life and I make awkward small talk with until he goes away again. So having all of his Moffatiness, I was not intrigued by. But any time that Peter Capaldi was just going to be like, I'm going to wear sunglasses, I'm going to make dad jokes, I'm going to play the Doctor Who theme on a guitar while riding on a tank. Because I can.
Who's going to stop me?
Yeah, who will stop me? I'm the Doctor. I do what I want. That I enjoyed. And weirdly, I actually really liked Missy.
I thought she was terrific. I think Michelle Gomez has put in, especially in these two episodes.
Bingo.
Really just put in terrific performances.
I hadn't worked through the way I felt about her in the season finale of last year. Because
now that some time has passed.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a shocker in a lot of ways.
There was just too much going on in that episode for me to really wrap my brain around this. I was sort of on the internet camp that was going, oh, but why is she the female master if she's acting more like the Rani? Also, not a huge fan of the Anthony Ainslie version of the master. So the fact that she was doing that was not really inspiring me. But in this two-parter, especially part two, she actually had a lot to do, and I really appreciate her acting, although I still think her writing is not very good. So I'm really looking forward to someone other than Moffat writing her, because I think she will really blossom at that point.
I do think that she's such a unique character, but the problem is Moffat basically writes one kind of woman.
Yeah.
One strong, sassy woman. And if there were just a few more edges on the characterization of Missy, just a few things that to set her apart from Sally Sparrow, from River Song, from whoever, Amy Pond, just to make her a little bit different, her mannerisms, but again, a lot of that is her, I think, the actress bringing that.
Bingo. Now that I've seen three episodes with Michelle Gomez portraying Missy, I am starting to pick up on which parts she's bringing to the role, and I love all of it. It's sort of like Peter Capaldi. I felt both Capaldi and Gomez were not given enough to do, but did amazingly with what they were given. So we'll call interesting concept, underwhelmingly written, with really good acting, and some pretty good twists and turns, and, oh, okay, I did not actually see that coming. So solidly enjoyable, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the season.
Yes,
especially the episodes Moffat did not write.
Fair enough.
back to the email. It was nice to hear you discuss Sleepy Hollow, which was a surprise find for us. We watched the first episode hoping for a good show, but not expecting one, and were pleasantly surprised. I think that's the perfect summary of Sleepy Hollow.
It was certainly
I really want this to be good, but I have no faith that it will be. How is this show this good?
That first season especially. I mean, the first season we absolutely loved. We bought the DVDs. It's beautiful DVD packaging, by the way.
Wonderful, wonderful season of television.
And I think we enjoyed most of the second, half of the second-ish, but the rate, not as much as the first.
No.
I'm differentiating loved from enjoyed.
Yeah. I'm going to put this, to bring this back to a Doctor Who metaphor. Season one of Sleepy Hollow was series five of Doctor Who. Just like completely new and out there and crazy
then
and
we
awesome.
Got season six.
And then season six happened. Yeah. And in season two of Sleepy Hollow, they clearly didn't have an end game. But unlike Gotham, where we were really excited that they didn't have an end game, season two just stank for me of inadequate plotting.
Yeah, I know the ratings were slipping. I think they were forced to make some changes, and they did. And I think you're pretty much out for season three. Is that right? Unless you hear great things, maybe. Is that, I don't speak for you, is that sort of where you're at?
If I hear really, really good things about season three, and I, you know, I still have some people who are still fans or at the very least, are still watching it, which is more than I'm doing.
Are they called Sleepyheads?
Yes.
Okay, I love that part. I watched the first episode of season three. And the fish out of water part, and I think Tom Meeson's charm.
Okay, yeah.
Is really all that was keeping me interested that in that one episode into the season. It seems it's going to be at this point more of a problem of the week, supernatural slash whatever other show that we've seen a million times.
Which, frankly, will probably get me back into it.
No, I understand that.
I've gone on these rants before. Maybe not on air. Maybe on air. I don't know. But you guys are going to listen to it possibly again.
I'm going
to
check out. Now I've heard this a few times.
I really am annoyed by the fact that freak, creature, case, etc. of the week is used as an insult. Like, I love that type of show.
It can be really good.
It is a style of storytelling. And it's one that I really enjoy because you get to see new and interesting stuff every time. But you need to have really good, consistent characters, and most importantly, you need to have character arcs.
Right.
That was why season one of Sleepy Hollow was so good, and why season two was
But now that they have changed some of the things, there is a scary potential arc. If they go love story with the two main characters, which we've been dreading for 2 years, even though they've written off other characters and past histories and all of that, I would be disappointed if it just turns into, say, Bones, supernatural Bones.
Yeah. Basically, once season three is over, if by the end of it, Ichabod and Abby have not kissed, I will give,
give it a shot
on Hulu.
Now, the problem for me is that once more shows start up, Supergirl, Flash, Arrow, etc., this is probably going to be the first one that will go, for me at least, way on the back burner.
This is the watch it because you're bored show.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Darren continues, we also enjoyed Constantine, and we're sorry to see it canceled.
Why you do that, Darren? Why you do that to my baby?
You should know better. I will never stop crying over Constantine! Ah! It was much better than its Friday night partner series, Grimm. Very true. While we don't dislike Grimm, it's rather bland, and is difficult to imagine it has run so long. Season 6 of Supernatural. What?
I know. A little bit of Constantine news. He, of course, will be appearing on Arrow at some point this season.
It's going to be the Halloween episode. So excited.
Of course. And to me, I hope that that opens up doors, portals, passages to a dark Justice League potentiality. We kicked around Zatanna. We kicked around Deadman before. Maybe this is just a crack that that aspect of the DC-verse can walk through.
Yes, and CW has gone on record saying that they're not going to do any more TV spin-offs that are DC-related. But we also know that network executives lie. So I'm hoping that is a, Yeah, we're absolutely not going to inundate our network with DC licensed properties. Unless they're doing really well.
Yeah.
So, hopefully this will be enough of a ratings bump for something down. I just want more Matt Ryan in the trench coat. Don't care about the context. He can be on any show. I've actually said this before. I really want him to show up on iZombie, but I recognize that one is a long shot.
For folks who did not see Constantine when it was on, and if you're one of the few people that has the El Rey network, reruns will be appearing on that network.
Woohoo! It still makes me happy to see Constantine in the news in any context. The magnum opus of feedback continues. We aren't big fans of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It's filled with okay stories and okay characters, but nothing that elevates it in our opinion. I will cut in here with the exception of Clark Gregg, who is phenomenal, regardless of the material, and is basically the only reason I've even considered ever going back, but...
Because you were out after season one, as was your mom. I kept watching it through season two, and I've started season three, and if you don't think too hard about it, especially how it fits into the greater MCU, because it really doesn't, even though they name check things, it's a much more enjoyable show. Continuity might not be their strong suit, but there's some interesting characters, including some of whom are not in the original cast. I think they've been able to adjust on the fly better than most shows have.
What you mean is Bobby Morse, Mockingbird.
And less of boring McBorington.
You mean evil boring McBorington? I liked regular vanilla boring McBorington. Thank you very much.
They were both pretty boring.
Dramatic sigh for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But Agent Carter was a fabulous show. We loved every minute of it and are happy to see it was renewed, though we're disappointed that it will be another short season. 22 episodes of Agent Carter in one session would be 22 hours well spent.
Well, on that, of course, we heartily agree.
Obviously.
We're looking forward to this next season in Los Angeles, although I still want them to go to the rebuilding of post-Blitz London. To me, that's the story that I want to see. Because to some extent, that is a historical post-apocalyptic story. That's a rebuilding story. I would love to see that.
Right. This goes to me having some issues, quibbles, with the way that Marvel is handling its TV properties. I think because the TV properties, you know, being ABC, owned by Disney, all under one big mouse-shaped umbrella, there's a lot of pressure. This is really what messes with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., for things to be really closely connected, and it does not allow for the weirdness that I'm really interested in seeing. It means that a lot of the properties that I really like and the concepts and stories that, at the very least, I am interested will probably never be on there. Things like, we really wanted them to make some sort of non-war story. The supernatural horror stuff. Like, the stuff that will never make it.
Right.
Really, the ABC shows are meant to be a launch pad and an interconnection with the movie universe specifically. And if it's not a thing, that'll end up in the movies somewhere. Like Peggy Carter, who came from the movies and is going back to the movies. Or Clark Gregg, same thing. Or with Daisy, her name is actually Skye Johnson, who is almost certainly going to be in the Inhumans. I mean, that's what they're doing with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is it's a giant prequel slash advertisement for the Inhumans movie that no one's going to go see. And as a result, they're kind of hobbled by the schedule.
That's definitely what I found with that season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., where they had to hit the Thor elements at exactly the right moment.
Yep.
And if you did what we did and got a couple weeks behind on the DVR.
Yeah, or accidentally,
accidentally
watched past and saw the episode that spoiled Captain America.
Exactly.
Like,
I mean, we saw Cap in like the third week. We just didn't see it the first weekend. I'm sorry, but somehow that was a problem. That was not built into their schedule.
Yeah.
And so that's true when they're trying to bring it that close, as opposed to just adding color you know, on the fringes of the universe, maybe.
Which is, frankly, what they're doing with the Netflix series, and is why I'm way more interested in the Netflix shows. Oh my gosh, they've dropped, like, 3 more teaser trailers for Jessica Jones.
Looks pretty good.
Don't give a damn about my bad reputation. I'm so ready for that. That is fun and interesting and adult and gritty and whatever, but just different. Whereas a lot of the ABC Marvel shows are just kind of homogenous.
A little bit.
And
I do think that's where Peggy Carter stood out. I do think the Agent Carter stood out.
Yes,
but they still had certain landmarks they had to hit, certain signposts they had to get to.
And the thing I'm worried about now is that now that she has a second season, now that it's not this fringe random thing that they threw off on the side.
It's going to get bland and homogenized and vanillaized.
They're moving her to LA, which I think is partially a budget thing, but also, like they've said, it's going to be like a noirish detective story. And though I've said I like Freak of the Week shows, do not like police procedurals. They bore me to tears. If they leave behind the interesting stuff, the historical spy thriller stuff, and do more detective-y, police procedural-y stuff, I am going to... I really don't want to check out, but I might check out.
I hope that's not the way they're going.
I have very little faith in ABC. Like, they are only going to do what is profitable. And I just...
Fair enough.
I want it to be good. I really, really do. Back to the email. Emily's discussion of iZombie was interesting, and while she compared it to other shows we enjoy, like Veronica Mars and Dead Like Me, she didn't convince us to give it a try. That's fine. But I still want Constantine to show up on iZombie, like, a lot. If only because in the very first episode of Constantine in the original pilot that didn't really go anywhere, his sidekick in that episode was a psychic named Liv. And I just really want him to show up in Seattle and mistake zombie Liv for psychic Liv. This would just make me very happy inside. Until then, I have fan fiction.
Exactly. Now, Emily has moved out of the house, finally.
Officially!
And into her own apartment. And you and your roommate are going to be cord cutters.
Mm-hmm.
But CW.com puts up his shows pretty quickly. Is it the next day? 24 hours?
12, maybe? Like
the next morning?
It's almost simulcast because they know how many of their fans are
young
teenage and, girls for the most part. And
so this is one I imagine you'll be able to keep up with.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't expect to DVR it myself, but I may watch the occasional episode here and there because I like the bits of it that I saw last year. But I don't need another 22-hour commitment.
That is the other thing, is that it was popular enough last season that it actually is getting a full season this time around. So there's going to be, like, whatever, 8 more episodes this year to watch. It's starting pretty much at the same time as all the real big girl shows. I'm excited. Interestingly, we had exactly the opposite opinion of Gotham that the two of you did. We quite enjoyed the early part of the season, but felt that by the end, it was too muddled and convoluted. The show went from being a must-watch for us early in the season to what we call a laundry show, meaning something we could have on in the background while doing other projects.
Which, by the way, is a great expression.
It really is. That's perfect. However, we enjoyed it enough that we will return for season 2. The actors playing Penguin and Riddler are great, and like you, we've always liked Miranda Baccarin. She was great in Firefly, and now in Gotham.
Yeah, we've banked the first 3 episodes on the DVR, but we like watching them together, you and I, and with you preparing to move and then moving. We haven't had the chance to sit down and do that just yet. But I have heard good things. I like the concept of focusing on the villains, and I hear that Barbara is actually an interesting character this season.
I will say, like, anything is better than boring. Evil included. Why I didn't like the first season of Clara... Second season of Clara, she was kind of a terrible person, but it was still so much better because she had a personality.
Yeah.
Personality of any variety is better than the alternative. I can see thinking that Gotham, especially by the end, was getting muddled and the cast was growing at a ridiculous rate, and that's why they kind of just started axing
people. So, hopefully.
So
that will help streamline that a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, and I totally get that. And but I really think that by the end, they really found their footing as far as all of the actors sort of having a handle on their characters, the writers having a better handle on their characters, the one massive improvement, aside from getting rid of Barbara, halfway through the season, is that I think the writers finally all got on the same page about how to write Jim Gordon. Because in the first 10 episodes, he is almost pathologically, insanely, like incompetently straight-laced. Do you genuinely not understand what is happening around you? Are you unaware? Like, how are you not keeping up with it? How... You know that all of your coworkers are corrupt. Why are you still surprised when it turns out your coworkers are corrupt? It was somewhere in the second half of season two that gave me one of my favorite lines I think Jim Gordon has ever said, which just sort of summed up what I think I really like about second half of the season, Jim Gordon. But there's some point they're interrogating some guy and he's being a skeevy creeper about whatever, possibly about Lee.
Right.
Miranda Baccarin's character. And Jim just gets this really... He gets the Batman look. He gets the steely eyes. And he just takes off his cufflinks and says, "Harvey, would you mind going around the corner and getting me a coffee? I'm about to break police procedural," as he starts rolling up his sleeves. It was still so straight-laced. And, like, I am very officially going to do this, and I'm going to announce my intent to do it because that is the procedure, is I have to tell you what I'm going to do before I'm going to do it. But also, I'm going to beat you like an ugly carpet. Was fantastic. And that sort of growth of the character, but I think more so just getting of the character, made the second half of the season much more watchable.
For us, right.
For us. Yeah. And I think once the writers have a plan and have good characterization, season two is primed to be pretty awesome.
I hope so.
The Sutherlands also enjoy the Flash TV series, as pretty much everyone in the entire planet does.
Yes. All the cool ones.
It's refreshing to have a light and fun adventure series. The villains have been interesting, and we have thoroughly enjoyed the Firestorm stories.
This is the one that's really family viewing for us. So even with Emily living elsewhere, we expect to keep this as the main priority for family viewing and an excuse to get Emily to come visit her parents every few weeks. That and bring laundry.
Yep. Laundry, dinner, Central City. It's a good plan.
Not bad.
The email continues. "It was interesting to hear your thoughts on some upcoming shows, especially your thoughts on whether or not Sci-Fi and TNT can afford the budgets needed for Krypton and Teen Titans. As Superman fans, we definitely give Krypton a try and hope for the best. However, you named some great shows that give us hope and again tell us we have similar tastes. Leverage was a 5-year favorite for us here on TNT. Ah, yes. A great ensemble series with a great cast. We were already fans of Timothy Hutton since his run as Archie on Nero Wolf. He was a perfect lead for the show. We've also been longtime fans of Gina Bellman from the fun Britcom Coupling. Aldous Hodge and Beth Riesgraf were fantastic, as was Christian Kane, who we are now happy to see in The Librarians, another fun TNT show. So here's hoping for the Titans."
Now here's my question. It seems that people who like Leverage are all pretty smart. Or is it just that when someone says they like Leverage, based on that, I just assume they're really smart?
It's a really good show. It is a really good show.
And you went the other way in terms of Nero Wolf. You noticed the Nero Wolf series at your library.
Because it had Nate on the cover.
Checked it out a few times, and basically you and Mom have watched about 2/3 of it.
Yeah.
Half of it, 2/3
of
it.
Yeah, all of season one and like a quarter of season two, probably. It's all put together in one big box set, so it's hard to tell, but...
And really enjoyed it.
Oh, so good.
They also mentioned that they liked Eureka and Warehouse 13, but then accused us of failing to mention Farscape. And I have found that in general, science fiction folks are either Farscape people or Babylon 5 people, and we are Babylon 5 people.
Yeah, I've just never really been interested in going back to Farscape, because basically I've seen Babylon 5, even like Star Trek TNG. I don't really have any deep abiding desire to go back and rewatch those shows, even though they got me into space opera as a child in the first place, because that pretty much that entire little corner of my heart is full of Bab 5.
But Emily has been spending some quality Netflix time.
Oh, yes.
With a variety of old sci-fi channel shows.
Yes, I have watched almost all of Warehouse 13. Last time we mentioned the show, I might have said I was 2 episodes from the end. I am still 2 episodes from the end because...
That is what we call leveraging a show.
I have commitment issues when it comes to television shows that when we get that close to the end, I just want to hold on. I know it's coming to an end, but just let me live this just a little bit longer. So I've still got the final 2 episodes of Warehouse 13. Actually filling the Warehouse 13-shaped void in my heart that I just don't want to move on from... actually went back and started watching some Haven. I really enjoyed that. Now, Warehouse 13 was sort of my previous benchmark of really good show from Sci-Fi Channel. Haven blows it out of the water. Oh, wow. Haven is a legitimate... I would watch this on ABC or mm-hmm. expect to see it on Fox or something. It's a legit awesome show. You know, the special effects are, of course, sci-fi level.
Yeah.
That is just to be expected. But they do a really good job of doing a lot with a little.
Right.
It's one of those sorts of... The whole... It always feels a little bit like a B-movie, but not like a schlocky,
right.
crappy,
right.
terrible
right.
B-movie. It's based on Stephen King.
So it takes place in Maine.
Of course it does. It takes place in Maine. Weird things are happening. But unlike every other Stephen King story, the weirdness starts like right away because it's
right. doesn't build in.
Because it's a TV show. It must have a freak every single week, right. which means that there's no time for this Stephen King faffing about in the woods doing nothing.
Now, speaking of this combination of Freak of the Week shows combining with long arcs and long storylines, you've also dipped yourself into the world of The X-Files.
Yes. I've actually been blogging this really, really aggressively on my Tumblr, but I'm really far behind in that, which is why I'm currently... I've sort of stopped until
to get caught up with your blog.
Until I catch up on the backlog, I think I'm like 4...
You're into season 3?
That's what I was just thinking. I think I stopped. I told myself gotcha. I could okay. not watch the finale... until I finished blogging season 2.
Got it.
And I'm like 15 episodes behind. So I'm going to work on that.
Got it.
After this moving, whole and unpacking nonsense that's going to take like 2 months. And eventually, I'm going to get back to X-Files. But man, is that a great show. And to tie back into Haven.
What?
Because Haven is rife with pop culture references. Mm. Many of them Stephen King references. Because
right.
since he has a producer's
right.
credit, they're going to do an episode that is just Christine. They have not yet done Carrie, but I have been told
that
it happens.
That's coming. Pennywise.
There was a Pennywise appearance. Someone name-checked Misery. And mm-hmm. one of the characters at one point was running around saying, I get to make the rules because I have the axe! And so, but I did almost fall out of my chair. Because the main character in Haven is... an FBI agent who's going around investigating all of this weirdness. And at one point her boss shows up and is giving her crap about having these really weird reports that don't make any sense. She said, okay, Agent Howard, you have no right to ever criticize me. You remember that one spooky guy you trained? He was a genius. What happened to him in the final years were regrettable.
That's perfect.
So, in other words, really good sci-fi series from yesteryear
yes.
have kind of been filling my heart right now. And I actually don't know what I'm going to do when the new TV shows come
yeah.
on. It's going to
be tricky.
It's going to be a really tight viewing schedule. Darren closes by apologizing for rambling too long as we pass the 28-minute mark.
We've done a little rambling here, too, in response, so that's just fine, buddy.
Time for everyone to wrap it up. Take care, Darren.
Now, on to some of our other episodes. We actually have other listeners who wrote in as well, including the great Luke Giaconetti.
Giaconetti.
He wrote in on our coverage of Convergence. Professor and Emily wanted to drop you both a line about the Convergence episode. I got the main series and some of the minis, and overall the whole thing left me with a big grin on my face. The only minis that both you guys and I got were these, Nightwing and Oracle. Full disclosure, You would require the use of an electron tunneling microscope to find my level of interest in either Nightwing or Oracle, especially when being written by Gail Simone. I bought this book entirely for the Flashpoint Hawks, who were, by the way, pretty darn awesome.
This is true.
They are worth the price of admission. Yes, Luke, they were. Simone, unsurprisingly, makes Hawkman a dumb brute and makes Hawkwoman a super capable, super tough, super awesome warrior woman. But it works all right. Oracle and Nightwing are annoying fan service, which you and I love, by the way.
Yep.
It served us.
We were well served.
But as villains, the very menacing Hawks succeed. So on that level, I enjoyed this mini, but there was too much typical fanfic-style shortcutting nonsense.
Well, you know what? I'll just be over here reading my fanfic nonsense, and honestly, different strokes for different folks.
Exactly. A Convergence JSA, just terrific fun. This one we are 100% in agreement.
Absolutely.
On. What more can he say about the legendary Justice Society going out for one last ride? I like that it brought in the kids from Infinity Inc. as well, a nice nod. The covers to this series were great, really gave a pulp adventure sort of vibe, which is appropriate for the Society. He also specifically mentioned liking Speed Force and the Batman and the Outsiders miniseries. And Luke concluded that overall he really enjoyed Convergence, despite the overwhelming negativity from griping internet comic book marks who weren't even reading it. It was a throwback to a sort of 90s crossover mashup smashup, and I thought it delivered exactly what it promised in that regard.
Yes.
And I think part of our issue was what people were expecting, what people thought they had been promised. And
yeah.
I think if you thought you had been promised what we thought and what Luke thought, it was perfect.
Yeah.
It delivered on that.
Yeah, I think...
If you were expecting something else...
I think what everyone probably wanted was 52, but nothing except 52 will ever be 52,
yeah.
Countdown included.
Yeah, right.
And that wasn't what they were trying for. So it's not like they tried to do the epic, sweeping, giant 54-issue mega arc and failed. That was never what they were going for. So I am glad that other people enjoyed it, because a lot of what I have seen as well has been the whiny, crybaby...
They didn't reset the universe like I thought they wanted
to. Well, I thought they were going to bring back the
end
thing.
The new 52.
No, it was going to be over.
It
was going to be 2005 again, and it was going to be everything I liked, because that's when I was reading comics, because then I was 19 and everything was perfect when I was 19. This said as someone who was a 19-year-old at this time.
So.
That is not how things work.
Mike Staley of the Invincible Iron Cast also wrote in on Convergence and on our anniversary. Hey, relative geeks. Congrats on your second anniversary. It's always awesome to see a series I enjoy make it this far. Sadly, a lot don't. DC's Convergence event was depressing for me mainly because of Batgirl. I'm a huge Cassandra Cain fan, and this was just another reminder that she's non-existent now. Don't get me wrong, I have no problem with Stephanie Brown. I just hate the fact that she's so heavily overshadowing Cass in the minds of many fans.
And in the book.
Right,
that
exactly,
was
yeah.
My biggest issue with that book is that Stephanie Brown is not a bad character, but...
She's not the only character.
Well, but let's follow up on this earlier thing. Doesn't have much of a personality.
Yeah.
Not that she has a bad one. She just kind of lacks one.
As for the topic of your second anniversary ep, I love the comic you guys looked at. I'm a Green Arrow fan already, and like Emily, I was introduced to the Question through the Justice League cartoon, and have grown to be a fan of him, or in Renee Montoya's case, her, ever since.
Oh my gosh, did you go through my garbage? Don't be ridiculous. I go through everyone's garbage. The plastic bits on the end of shoelaces are called aglets. Their true purpose is sinister. Best question ever. Shag also commented on that episode. I received a notice from my lawyer and news clipping service that I was mentioned once or twice on this episode. Therefore, I have given your show a listen. You're welcome.
You know, we recently had lunch and an afternoon of comic book shopping with Shag and some other of our local comic book and podcast friends. We did this last year as well. And for those of you who know Shag, you know that hanging out with him for a few hours once a year is about perfect.
Sick burn! Shag's actual feedback says, first and foremost, I blame both Professor Quarterbin and Emily for hurting my wallet. I had no plans to pick up any Convergence comics. Thanks to your coverage leading up to the event, I ended up getting about a dozen of those miniseries. Darn you, Middletons! Our work here is done. A few standout issues for me were Justice Society of America.
Of course.
Superman.
Yeah.
And Blue Beetle. I thought the JLI issues were weak, and Blue Beetle was a much more enjoyable presentation of Beetle and Captain Atom. Mm-hmm. Agreed. Speaking of new DC Comics, I'm only collecting Justice League 3000. It's an absolute blast. I love this comic. I still don't know quite to think of Justice League 3001.
3001, yeah.
I just can't get a read on it, personally, but I'm very hopeful of it getting collected in trade and ending up at the library where I can check it out and just see what it was.
Yeah. On that question annual that we covered, Jason Trenner pointed out that we missed Captain Atom in our discussion of the Charlton heroes like Blue Beetle and the Question that had gone on and to become presences in the DCU.
This is mostly just because Captain Atom showed up a little bit in the Justice League animated series, and he showed up in two Convergence books, and those are the only times I have ever seen him.
Yeah, it's possible Jason included a few Transformers references in his email, too, but...
You know, par for the course.
Probably.
On our anniversary episodes, we got nice comments from folks who will miss uncovering the Bronze Age.
Aww.
Noel, our Dr. Frederick Wortham from episode 5, commented, "It's sad to hear of the passing of Uncovering the Bronze Age. But I know all too well, I hate love remakes, that when something has passed its time, it has passed its time. And I wish you all the best in moving forward. I'll always remember UBA, not only for being what brought me to the network, but for how honored I was by Emily's invite to participate in the Wortham episode and how amazing that turned out. Thank you so much and best of luck."
Jason Trenner, he was sad that Uncovering the Bronze Age has died. "Here I was hoping for more Clark Jr. and Bruce Jr. material, among other things. Oh well."
Well, you know, it's not like I have lost my microphone, or like Michael Bradley has lost my Skype contact information. I'm just saying, feminazi, alien eyeball, mind control, pyramid, swamp women. Call me!
If he does that episode with anyone else, I'm going to go to Indiana and just probably have a nice coffee with him because he's such a nice guy.
Mildly reprimand him, shake your finger at him disappointedly.
And then have a nice chat probably. So
most likely.
Well, you know, you were able to bully Sean Engel into getting you on his show. I don't know if it would work with Mike. I wouldn't even want to bully Mike.
Yeah, he's just too nice.
Same. Not the same. Oh, well. We also announced on that episode our new endeavor, Dorkness to Light, and there have been some blog posts that we've done, some tumbling, and one podcast episode so far. We got very encouraging comments from people to get that going, and we really appreciate that. We're just going to pull out a few of the comments here.
Noel said that, although an outsider himself, he finds much about religion and explorations of faith interesting to listen to.
Mike Staley said he was looking forward to it and gave a few suggestions, including the new Ms. Marvel book, which is on the shortlist.
Absolutely. Neil Stanifer, the grammar merchant, titled his email "Relatively Giddy" or "Relatively Weepy." He asked if we were deliberately trying to knock his emotion meter out of calibration. "Did you mean to make me throw a fist bump and shout woot at the announcement that Darkness to Light was becoming a reality? Only to groan, boo, and hiss at the announcement that Emily will no longer be producing Uncovering the Bronze Age. I call shenanigans! Well, I suppose I'll have to play with the cards I've been dealt and focus on the positive. And at least there is still the hope that Emily will bring her considerable talents to some Bronze Age titles on the Shortbox Showcase."
We certainly expect that to be the case.
Yes, and, like I said, I am all about talking about 70s comics with other people on their shows. Just, I edited 5.5 episodes of a show, and that was about 4.5 episodes of editing too much.
But you wouldn't mind one day getting back to the bins of some kind,
right? Or you know, digging around in a long box graveyard or
whatever it would take. Yeah. Who knows? Whatever.
And to name drop the Netflix Marvel initiative, The Defenders. What with this Luke Cage thing coming up? Mm. There might be some Heroes for Hire discussion in the future.
It could happen. It could happen. Stay tuned. Stay subscribed.
Where's my money, honey?
We're going to play a promo here, a couple of promos, and when we get back, we're going to give the comic book companies a piece of our mind. Maybe a little bit of advice. When you think of podcasts about religion, you probably think of this.
But at least one religion podcast sounds more like this.
I kick ass for the Lord!
Dorkness to Light is a relatively geeky production in which Alan and Emily discuss topics of faith, religion, and spirituality.
But we do so through the lens of pop culture, like movies, TV, and comic books, because we're nerds.
Our primary focus will be on Christianity, because that's what we know best. But all religious content is on the table.
Well, think about it, Scully, from vampirism to Catholicism.
This is an occasional cast, to be recorded and released as the mood strikes, with topics ranging from in-depth reviews to personal rants about some small aspect of theology or church history, because we're theological nerds.
If these topics interest you, check out dorknesstolight.blogspot.com for our more regular content.
Or dorknesstolight.tumblr.com for our more irregular content. Memes and puns, mostly. My bad.
Dorkness to Light.
Often irreverent, rarely sacrilegious. And we're back.
On a recent episode of the Comics Reading Journal, I mentioned that I had picked up a copy of the Ms. Tree Quarterly. And one of the things I really liked about that issue was that it had a text piece at the back of it. Well, they did it as an illustrated novel. It was about 8 pages, 10 pages, and each page had not panels, but had 2 or 3 pictures sort of in the background, and they wrapped the text around them at times, so they came part of the design element. But you got this sort of neat combination of art and words, although in a little bit different format than the traditional comic story. And I really enjoyed that. I talked to Emily about that, and we were just kicking around the idea of whatever happened to the illustrated novel? Was it ever a thing?
Personally, I'm a big fan of the concept of illustrated novels and have been for most of my life. Because even when I was a wee little thing, the first books that I had were the A.A. Milne, original old printed collections of Winnie the Pooh stories. And each one of those, at the start of each chapter, had a little illustrated scene at the top of the page and had a full image before each story.
And then there are usually a couple of pictures on the pages during the story as well.
Like with that story, worked in around the text, right, so that they were part of the way that the page was laid out. And same thing with the Beatrix Potters.
Oh, right.
And that was just a thing that I really enjoyed. The first time I ever came across that in a full novel form was The Invention of Hugo Cabret, which if you have not read it, you absolutely should. It's like a middle gray teen-ish book. It's, you know, pretty easy reading. But if you pick it up, it's about 1,200 pages. It's about 5 inches thick. And that's because about for every 10 or 15 pages of text, there's a 3 or 4 page comic worked into the story that shows some of the action. And it's just an awesome book. It looks really cool. And I've just been a big fan of that sort of sketchy style. When I saw the text piece, oh my gosh, yes, I've missed this.
Now, to be fair, the one that I was looking at, the story was by Denny O'Neill.
And
the art was by Mike Grell. So it looked great. It was a great story. It was sort of best of both worlds. But I really like the concept as well as mm-hmm. that specific story.
And we've talked about this, you know, before. We talked about superhero prose.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. And maybe not in any particular episode, but we've talked about before our love of backup stories.
Mm, right.
You know, in the All-Star Western books, that was part of my favorite thing that drew me to the stories every time. Is I'll be like, oh yeah, this continuing thing with Jonah Hex, okay, yeah, sure. But what's this interesting backup story? There's an Asian woman who everyone thinks is a ghost because she died in a mine accident, and now she's taking revenge on the people that killed her father. Or
they would do that. That would be
Cinnamon
like
and Nighthawk
for like two issues at a time, two or three issues. There would be these running backups and, in those, and they were really enjoyable.
And you know, not to completely crap on decompressed storytelling, you know, I like my decompressed stories, but it was really refreshing to be able to get a complete beginning, middle, and end for a story in about 10 to 15 pages.
Right, maybe 2 6-page backups or something like that.
Or if it was a really ongoing thing, there was Dr. 13 and right. his awesome steampunk ghost-fighting blimp crew. That was a grand total of like 18 pages in between 4 books.
Right.
But that was like an epic, sweeping story, and it was so small and simple, and it was really nice.
And one of the things we've complained about, it's in the promo for the Quarterbin podcast, $4 books that you can read in 4 minutes. And that Ms. Tree Quarterly, it was a long book, it was an 80-pager, but about half the time it took me to read it was to read that 10-page prose piece. Not took as long as the 50 pages of comic book before that. And I really enjoyed that about it.
Right.
I liked that it gave me a chance to dig in and, to put it in finance or economic terms, to amortize my cost over more minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're, you know, paying full price, there is something annoying about flipping through it and being done before you've actually finished settling comfortably into your chair.
Yeah.
And we were thinking that the introduction of either a straight text piece, like they used to do for the postage rates back in the Silver Age, or this illustrated novel approach that would give you 5 or 10 or 15 more minutes of seat time with the comic.
Yeah.
As the backup, I think, is sort of what we were potentially thinking.
Right. And this is something that I have come across as I've gone back and bought more 70s and 80s books, is just... I don't think it's just me, but the books are physically smaller. They're thinner. And I pick it up and I'm like, my God, like, this weighs like 2.5 ounces and it costs $4. Although we're cheap and we buy books that no one else does. So, you know, $2.99.
Yeah.
Still, $2.99 and it's like nothing.
It would float away if you didn't bag and board it. That,
right.
I think some of these books.
Exactly. And I was just thinking about this. There is... People have talked about, you know, the joys of reading a physical book and that will never go away because you have something to actually physically hold in your hands. There's a weight to it. And I was trying to figure out why I was kind of annoyed by modern comics. And it's not the decompressed storytelling. I like taking
right.
more pages to tell a story. However, I would like to have more of those pages per volume.
Right.
That's the part that annoys me. I was never a letter hack, really. I didn't really care about letter pages, but modern comics don't have them, and they're thin without them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, we need something to bulk it out. You don't even need to have, like, a really big named creator if these are just your backup pieces.
Part of the potential issue you had, well, the cost. If you're physically going to add a few more pages... That's going to be more pages for the art, more pages for the story. And Emily sort of had this idea of you could use this a little bit as a sort of a tryout sort of idea.
Yeah, once upon a time, you know, a lot of things with the letter pages that I never really cared about was that letter pages, you would find names that were involved in the fandom who would go on to become creators. And that's part of the cool thing about going back and looking
right.
at old letter pages is finding letters from George Martin.
Exactly.
Or, you know, Dennis O'Neill or mm-hmm. whoever. Writing into these comics when they're younger and talking about how much they love this and how it's inspiring them to get into writing. And I was thinking about, like, that whole sort of subculture
yeah, what's,
has gone away.
What's What's the fandom equivalent of that today?
Back in the old days, before the internet, and frankly, before you wouldn't want anyone to have your full legal name, address.
And physical address through the 1970s.
Email, phone, all of that information, which was published in your letter pages. Those letter pages were a way for fans to contact one another.
Right.
And a lot of times start mailing groups and local fan clubs and fanzines. I had a couple fanzines that I, you know, followed back when I was like 10 or 12, but they've pretty much entirely gone extinct.
Right.
And I was trying to just think about this whole subculture that of the letters and the fanzines and the fan groups. Like, they've all kind of gone away.
And then the fanzines, like you said, the letter pages would lead to the fanzines, which would lead to jobs writing comics on occasion.
Mm-hmm. It was sort of a way to get your art out in a semi-professional...
underground, unofficial sort of way of distributing your... working on your craft and maybe getting a name out.
Yeah, but in an almost semi-professional sense. That if there was a really big fanzine, you could write into Marvel and say, my work has been published in these 17 issues of this fanzine that's fairly well-known and widely distributed.
Take a look at this.
Look at my things, and you can find this here. And do I have a portfolio. And I was thinking about that. I was like, how can... you know, comics fans who are sort of interested in getting into the industry, why don't we have these? Why don't we have these places where people can pick over for new names? And I kind of realized what we have now instead. That all of this stuff, the, you know, fan contact, fan groups, fan works, publication of fan art and fan stories.
It does exist.
It's all moved to the internet. It's all in fan fiction and fan art and online communities and live journal things and subreddits and things of that nature. The problem with all of that stuff is that, unlike with fanzines, there is no gatekeeper.
True.
Anything that you put out there is just out there. And for obvious reasons, Marvel cannot use any of it.
Right. And that is why I let you tell me a few funny lines and a few interesting storylines from your fanfic diving, as opposed to doing it myself. For one thing, I tried reading one, and there was a spelling mistake in the first paragraph and grammar in the third, and I had to try to get my red pen out.
You were done.
And I couldn't. It just, that's my own bias towards it. But you don't bring that to it. You just brought a desire to see these characters.
Mm-hmm.
Adventures continue in some format. Did it start with Constantine? Was it sort of in terms of your latest dive into fan fiction?
Yeah, it started with Constantine because 13 episodes, it was over.
And it was not enough. You were not over.
I needed more content. And whatever quality of the content, I just needed some fix. And so I went to the fan fiction. And then pretty much as soon as I got the news that Constantine was not in any way, shape, or form coming back, and I had to sort of let that candle float out onto the open abyss of sadness, this wonderful thing called Daredevil came along.
Mm.
And then I delved pretty hardcore into the Daredevil fan fiction. Because again, 13 episodes. And it was over. And I was like, I'm not
done. I've got to wait a year for another 13 episodes of Daredevil? But there were plenty of people willing to supply your Daredevil fix.
Yes, willing to give me just tons of interesting content. And a lot of it did not appeal to me. And some stuff was very work inappropriate. But there were a decent amount, like maybe 10, 15, 20 stories that I found from a couple specific writers.
That were really good.
That were really good quality. And there was one in particular that I did actually send to you that I finished it. And it was like, it was long. It was like 48,000 words. I got to the end and I was like, that was a novel. That was a full, long going story.
That could be published.
That had like character arcs and really good setting descriptions and use of all four. It was Daredevil. Senses and like, you know, building these intricate descriptions and interesting dialogue and character interactions and all this stuff was really well handled. And I thought, I'd pay $2.99 for a paperback of that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was not high literature, but it was certainly as good prose as Emperor Doom or the the Clone Saga novels, right, or anything like that, you know, a Star Wars mass market paperback. I was like, that was of the same quality. And I started thinking about that as, you know, there really should be some sort of way that if those writers, who are really good, can get their name out professionally writing with these characters that they love and they want to write for. Because somebody, Mark Waid, maybe, possibly, I don't know, said that everyone who's working in comics is writing fan fiction. Most of the characters that are in comics were not created in the last 5 to 15 years by anyone who's currently working in comics.
Right, with the exception of some indies.
Yeah.
When you look at DC and Marvel, it's 99.9% is being written by the person who did not create it.
Yeah. That, you know,
which is the definition of fan fiction.
Exactly. That those are pre-existing characters. You know, essentially all comics are licensed fiction.
Playing in someone else's sandbox with someone else's own characters.
Bingo. I was just trying to wrap my head around this. And this happened at the same time that we found that Mystery Annual. And I thought, these are two great tastes that would taste great together. That is a way for DC and Marvel to, A, bulk out their page count without, hopefully, upping the price of their comics. At least not much. But you can, you know, if you don't have to pay for a writer, artist, inker, colorist.
If these are amateur or semi-pro writers, probably pay the professional minimum, you know, per word count or something like that, and they would be excited by that. And in terms of the art, for an 8-page story, you would just need maybe, you know, 16 type of shots, you know, a couple per page, and they wouldn't have to be in terms of the storytelling mechanics. They can really be more just scenes.
Yeah, sort of pinup style.
Right.
But two people could essentially just send in a portfolio. Here's three stories I wrote that, you know, show the way that I visualize Matt Murdock and his voice and think about that, you know, if you are interested in this, and then here's an original piece and something with another character.
Right.
And just send that in, and then DC or Marvel or whoever goes, you know, that's pretty good. Can you write 1,200 words about this? Or we're doing a backup involving this character. What do you think about that? And get little bits and pieces here and there. Commission an artist. Stick the two together. You only really need to pay three people. One person on layouts, a writer, and an artist. That keeps your costs down. And it's a place for people to get their name out. Because that's the thing. For example, that writer who I like is Chuckle Voodoos. Like, I have no idea who this person is. I don't know. They might be a semi-professional or professional writer, but I have no way of knowing.
Right.
But this would get their actual legal name out in a way that they can then use in a portfolio. I just, like, had this crazy giant revelation. DC, call me!
And there are logistics and legal reasons why this, as we've specifically laid it out, probably couldn't work. But we think conceptually, we kind of like the idea. And just, for one thing, comics industry has been going on for about 80 years. Maybe they need to try something different.
And it's not even that different. This is a thing that was working 30 years ago.
That's right. Do something just a little different. And then what we would say in terms of the collection, then you could collect the illustrated portions, these illustrated short stories, collect those as digital, either novels only or with the art as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
essentially sell it as an annual. At the end of each year, like collect the stories and ebooks or physically, or
and if you sell it as a paperback, you could probably get $5.99 for it, $7.99 if you throw in the illustrations and depending on the number of pages.
And that's essentially free money at the end of every year.
I think it's crazy, but it might be crazy enough to work.
And that's the thing, like the whole reason that prose was in comics anyways, back in the 30s,
40s and 50s,
50s. Like the whole reason it was there was shipping costs.
Right.
The big two keep fighting with online distribution and trying to find a way to make it work. Like, there's this hurdle there. I'm thinking
people are already reading plenty of e-books. I think that would be an easier transition for people than the straight digital comic, perhaps.
There is a place there where there is an overlap and there is an untapped market. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of people who are interested in prose, clearly. Lots and lots of people interested in prose that features their favorite comics characters. There should be a way to tap that market and maybe help keep the occasionally, frequently struggling comic companies
right.
a little financially afloat.
And they have tried the straight prose novel many, many times. I heard just recently that Marvel was going to introduce their first ever YA novel series.
Oh, and you laughed because
it would be
Mary
about
Jane loves Spider-Man.
That and the She-Hulk Diaries. It would be about this their seventh attempt at a first time ever. And they've tried those plenty of times, and they tend to not succeed for whatever reason. The leap from comics to prose is a little harder, but if you had this in-between stage, short story and illustrated, I think that might be a bridge or a place where those fandoms can come together.
And I work at a library. I am pro actual print prose reading. A lot of the times, you know, librarians and school administrators and people that are pro comics say, like, and the great thing about comics is that they are a springboard into reading general fiction, standard prose. And this would just be one more step. It would be an optional thing there at the end, but just, hey, you got your cool, pretty pictures that you're interested in this ongoing thing. And here's a little short story at the end that you might enjoy. I know that you like these characters because you're buying this book. It seems like a natural progression, and in my mind seems like an obvious thing to implement. Of course, will probably never
there
happen.
Plenty There's plenty of obvious things that the comic book company should implement that they don't.
Exactly. But we can hope. We can dream.
We can suggest.
Yes. DC, call us.
We'll just listen to this.
Steal our ideas, please. You can have it for free.
So we would love to hear from you about this crazy notion of ours, about illustrated comics, about backup features, about short story prose featuring your favorite comic book character.
About trying to make your comic actually worth the $4 that you're shilling out every single month.
That is true. If anyone else wants to come out of the woodwork and admit that they're a fanfic consumer, here is a safe place. Come and let us know what you think about this crazy idea of ours.
Send any of your feelings about all of that to us through email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com.
And as you know from the first half of this episode, if you send it,
we will read it
and then talk incessantly about it.
Mm-hmm. You can also Facebook us. We have a page for Relatively Geeky. Or check out our blogspot, relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com.
If you like what we have going here, we invite you to leave an iTunes review. That helps more people find us, and we would definitely appreciate that.
Thanks for listening to all of our crazy, rambling, possibly nonsensical ideas.
The word manifesto may be going through someone's mind now, and I'm just
whatever. It happens. You gotta own it.
You just gotta keep in mind, when we come up with harebrained ideas like this, we are not experts.
We're just family. We had exactly the opposite opinion of Gotham that the two of you had. It was gonna happen eventually.
Or is that not what we were going to say?
Well, it is, but I had a place I was going in between them.
I'm sorry.
No, because you were given a good lead-in, and then you started you wandered off into the brambles. And I was like, come back. Bam.